I don't know how this is going to go because I'd planned on about an hour and a half of sucking up coffee before I faced y'all, but here we go. All right. Elliot Everett Oberstein. You can't hear me. Is the mic on? Yes? I just got to get close. You can hear me. Very good, Mike. Those of you who know about him already know that we could spend the whole morning just swapping Eli stories. But for those who don't recognize the name, I would rather introduce him as a tireless Victor executive who virtually created the Bluebird label in the 30s. He produced the majority of its output until he left in 1939. He signed Benny Goodman when he was not the king of swing. He just had kind of a so-so band. He signed Tommy Dorsey before he even had a band. In 1936, he became the head of artist and repertory for both Bluebird and Victor Popular. By 1939, he'd added Glenn Miller and Artie Shaw and Larry Clinton to the Victor roster. So basically, for someone who was about to go out on his own, he had set up his rival company in pretty darn good shape. He actually returned to RCA in 1945 after selling out his classic records to Majestic for over $500,000. When he came back, he completely changed Victor's direction from the swing era to Perry Como and Vaughn Monroe and all those other wonderful records we love to find in junk stores. Billboard described his personal holdings. It is known that he holds interest in several pressing plants, an album and sleeve manufacturing factory with a paper outlet, property in upstate New York, several theaters through New York, New Jersey, etc. He has acted as consultant for various indie labels, has written songs under various noms de plumes, and withal has sized up as one of the most powerful men in the record biz. But it had been a long, hard climb for him. Back at Victor, it had just been a matter of marshaling its vast resources in an efficient way possible. But when he started his United States Record Corporation in 1939, basically, he began a year-long series of running battles with publishers, bankers, and band leaders. His partner, the Scranton Record Company, filed for bankruptcy on August 31, 1940. The U.S. followed a few days later. The thumbnail sketch. For my first recorded selection, I'd like to present one of my favorite sides. It's called Zonky by Six Men and a Girl. Kind of an obscure thing. Zonky's a Fats Waller tune. The girl is pianist Mary Lou Williams, and the six men are from Andy Kirk's band. So here's a real fine piece of Kansas City jazz from January of 1940. We could roll the first selection. Or I could hum a few bars.
How about six people? You know you're right to tell me it's one by the next.
Thank you.
All right, I'm finally awake, I guess. You notice the sound wasn't really great on that. I'd say Eli's output is probably about the most uncollectible batch of records you'll ever run across. They were not well produced, they were not well pressed, they were just marketed like crazy. This is the one and only picture I've been able to find of Eli Oberstein, despite the virtually hundreds of magazine and newspaper articles about him. This is Eli with Lydia Mendoza in San Antonio back in 1935 producing a Bluebird session. And I want to thank Chris Strachwitz of Arhuli Records for this. Years ago, the patent office used to actually print up the trademarks and send them to you if you send them like a buck and a half or something. So this is the Varsity trademark and the Royale trademark. Varsity was 35-cent cheapies. Royale was 50-cent cheapies. Pardon me? Varsity was 35 cents at the most. Once bankruptcy hit, you could pick them up for 10 or 12 cents at a lot of outlets, especially around New York City. The bankruptcy was more like a messy divorce. The Scranton plan attempted to sell Eli's masters to itself for $16,000. That's about $10 a side. The proceedings dragged along for about 6 months. Amazingly enough, Eli pretty much had things his own way. He got to keep all his masters. $67,000 in claims against the company was dismissed, and he was on his way. By November of 1940, he was back with a new line called Imperial. The label was changed to Elite because it turned out there was already an Imperial record company floating around someplace. And at the end of December, he merged with a classic company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Let's see what's next. There's a Varsity record. Varsity picked up a whole lot of oddball masters along with 1,000 or so it recorded itself. This one is from Baldwin. There are things from Amar and a whole bunch of obscure labels. He had worked for Jeanette at one time in the 20s, so he managed to work a deal with someone at Jeanette. So he dubbed off a whole lot of their masters and released them. This is a test pressing, and if you look on the left-hand side, it says Result 39, and for years I wondered what kind of a result that was. It turned out the Scranton plant was selling test pressings during the recent unpleasantries, and the average stuff was 39 cents. The risque things by John Ryan and people like that were a dollar. This is a one-sided test, by the way, for 39 cents. The U.S. masters show up on all sorts of little oddball labels. This may have been pressed along with some Musicraft things on Masterpiece. What you look for is the matrix number. The U.S. prefix has been overstruck, so it looks like 08. Continental was one of the many beneficiaries of that. In fact, let's hit our next selection, because this is it, Pete Daly's Arkansas Fiddlers.
With a deck of cards, so willingly I sit down. I've gambled down in Dixie, I've gambled up in Maine. I'm going back to Georgia to gamble my last game. I had not been in Washington many many more weeks and three when I fell in love with a pretty little girl and she fell in love with me. She took me in the parlor, she cooled me with her fan, she whispered low in her mother's ear, I love the gambling man. Oh, daughter, oh, dear daughter, how could you treat me so, to leave your dear old mother and with the gambler go? Oh, mother, oh, dear mother, you know I love you well, but the love I have for the gambling man no human tongue can tell. I wouldn't marry a farmer, he's always in the rain. The man I want is a gambling man who wears a golden chain. I wouldn't marry a railroad man, and here's the reason why. I never seen no railroad man who wouldn't tell a lie. I wouldn't marry a doctor, he's always gone from home. All I want is a gambling man, he won't leave me alone. I'll bundle up my clothing, with him I'll leave my home. I'll travel the wide world over, wherever he may roam. I hear the train a-comin' round a curve, a-whistlin' and a-blowin' and strainin' every nerve. Oh, mother, oh, dear mother, I'll tell you if I can, if ever you see me comin' again, I'll be with a gamblin' man.
Yes.
The same Pink Daly that had the Dixieland band in the 50s?
I suspect not. Ah, that explains why it's a dub. Okay. Thank you.
What did he say? I didn't hear it.
It's a dub from Crown. Okay. Crown was one of the major feeder labels that he took from. They had produced records in the early 30s. RCA Victor had pressed them, so obviously he had access to something through his connections there. He had also produced some of the sides for Crown, like the Fletcher Henderson things. Yes?
All the Crowns you've turned up so far, are they dubs? Have you found any pressings from masters?
No, everything was dubbed because he wanted to make sure they'd run on the jukeboxes.
Crowns were not dubbed. Yeah, I've got at least one press from a master.
Really?
Yeah.
There are no Crowns.
The Varsity.
That's what I'm saying. No, the Varsity I have is pressed from a Crown master. I'll tell you about it.
That's untypical. The ones I've seen have been dubbed. Like I said, he wanted to make sure they'd run on the jukeboxes. Okay. Usually. Sometimes he didn't put lead-in grooves in for some reason. Anyway, getting back to 1941. Wartime restrictions on shellac and other war materials had most of the smaller labels very, very worried. But Eli was very confident. He had just taken delivery on a shipment of shellac from a torpedoed freighter. I guess a little salt water and shrapnel couldn't make his pressing sound much worse than they already did. So. Anyway, back to the elite. His records, as he goes along, the output tends to get blander and blander. This was maybe his last hurrah as far as good music was concerned. Bunny was just about dead of alcoholism by this time, but he managed to put out some pretty decent records. In 1942, he added a 50-cent hit label. Basically, he needed to beat the OPA price restrictions. Decca did the same thing with their black label. At this time, Eli was also dickering with MGM to start up a new label. Tommy Dorsey's contract was almost up with Victor, and it seemed as though a deal might be made, but wartime shortages made MGM nervous, so they shelved the plan for a few years. I think if I had to point to one event that really defines Eli's character, it would have to be his response to the strike by the American Federation of Musicians that began in August of 1942. The musicians' union was headed by the powerful and militant and aptly named James Caesar Petrillo, who defied the government, ignored the courts, and cowed the big three record companies. Oberstein just kept making records. Petrillo was obviously outraged when publishers informed him that Eli was applying for licenses on tunes published after the ban took effect. And the union attempted to intimidate him with an inquisition. Those masters were made in Mexico, said Señor Oberstein. Call it bootlegging, but it's legal. Petrillo was livid, but couldn't find any musicians stupid enough to admit scabbing for Oberstein. The union asked publishers to refuse to grant licenses. They declined, citing restraint of trade laws, and they also liked to have some money rolling in. Eli tendered his resignation to Local 802, but they said, basically, you can't quit until we fire you. Then Eli cited the fact that the majors were using imported recordings and threatened to sue the union for reinstatement. Hit did stop releasing these dubious no-name sides that he'd recorded, and when Decca finally settled with the AFMM in August, Oberstein immediately began his own negotiations, and apparently all was forgiven, and Eli led all the independent labels to a settlement in November of 43. As a sidelight to all this, a small item appeared in Variety in October of 1942, announcing that the Continental Record Company of New York had cut six sides in Mexico, including Der Führer's face. Now, this appears on the obscure Victory label backed by one of these old Varsity masters. Could it have anything to do with Eli? And as a sidelight to the sidelight, there was a hit release of Der Führer's face credited to Arthur Fields. It is not by the real Arthur Fields, who made many recordings in the 20s, and Arthur took Oberstein to court over the use of his name. Eli claimed it was just a name picked at random. No harm intended, you know. People get so excited. One of the things that sustained Eli during the ban was a deal with Firestone to lease part of the old Varsity catalog. Obviously, tires were virtually unobtainable for civilians, and Firestone had to sell something at those retail outlets. That's right. In 1944, MGM was back at Eli's door. Hit recorded and pressed two obscure Lion releases. If anybody has a copy, I'd like to see one of those. They pressed up 2,000 to distribute to the trade, and then the masters were turned over to Eli for release on his Hit label. This is the Majestic record that Eli sold out to for a cool $500,000 plus. He had to split it with his partner, but it's still pretty good. Not bad at all. I think for my final musical selection, I'll backtrack again. Varsity's one real success was a mildly risque tune by Johnny Messner's band called She Had to Go and Lose It at the Astor. It sold over 100,000 copies, maybe 200,000 copies, but somehow the RIAA never quite got around to certifying it for a gold record. Eli announced in Time magazine that the double entendre era had arrived. Apparently this was the successor to the swing era, though we didn't know it. And after U.S. got tied up in its bankruptcy proceedings, Oberstein and Messner got together and started Top Hat Records, which recycled the earlier Astor and some new things by the band, masquerading as the Ramblers. So here is the Johnny Messner Orchestra doing the Whistle Blues. No children in the audience.
take the radio commercial of cigarettes and gas. You can take each bar of soap they're plugging and you can take the crooning barroom tenor and every movie lass. Take the high sopranos and falsettos and
take the news of Mussolini that is not so keen. Take the Japs and Hitler, and you know what I mean.
You can take the long-haired jazz musicians, their instruments of brass. You can take the drums and all the cymbals, and you can take the motor cars and drivers, the awful smell of gas. You can take the driver in the backseat and you can take the taxis in the city alone or in a mass. Take the trucks and all the fire hydrants and
you can take the Keystone cop who thinks that he is great. You can take his lecture and we hope you've got it straight.
You can take that bunch of Sunday drivers who just won't let you pass. You can take the detours and the stoplights and
I was just going to play excerpts, but there really hasn't been a lot of recorded sound here, especially anything less than 60 years old, so. I'm just going to show you a few of the oddball labels that Eli had. After 3 years back at RCA, Oberstein felt the call to independence once again. There was another AF of M strike, and it was time to do some more recording. He worked for something called Atlantic Sound Mass Recording, which engaged in supplying international masters to American companies, basically music backgrounds that they could dub singers onto. In July of 48, his new Wright Records reintroduced the old Varsity trademark, and he also started up a label in Chicago called Rondo. In July of 49, he got involved with Columbia in a joint venture to market budget Harmony labels. That lasted about 6 months. There was a lot of friction, so you don't see an awful lot of them after the initial issues. Wright merged with Regent and Allegro to become the Record Corporation of America, which certainly must have pleased RCA no end. Eli finally sold all that stuff to Pickwick International. It's pretty much gone with the wind by now, I imagine. They might have some tapes of early 50s dubs, but that would be about it. And Rondo was his main interest. Well, that was a real successful picture, wasn't it? He continued until his death on June 12, 1960, at the tender age of 58. As an independent record producer, he really overcame adversity and thrived on ambiguity. He loved to make records, but even more, he liked to sell records. And he never let an attachment to any particular genre or artist cloud his vision of the bottom line. Any questions?
Yeah. I would have thought that you would have dealt more with Crowder, which was his initial entree into the record business, and he was a success as a lower-priced entity through RCA. He was upgrading that label out of his hip pocket, even while he was replacing and some say having undercut Ralph Peer at RCA. The Bluebird label begins with the demise of Crown early in 1933. And I think there's a very intimate connection. Some of the early Bluebirds, in fact, are not RCA products. There's no RCA in the label. The logo is blue on white, and they're purely Crown products. I think he is the man that really launched the secondary lower price operation for a major record label as a way to keep doing business during the Depression and compete with the ARC and Plaza and that bunch of
Yes, his two hits for two bits deal was a real success. But my research is mostly in the 40s when he was doing his party records, and that's what I know best, so that's what I concentrated on. Obviously, you could do an hour on Crown and do some marvelous things. Yes?
Well, along that line, where does Electric Disc and Timely Tunes fit in? Did Overseas have anything to do with those either?
That would take up more of the...
but is there that relationship to it?
Yeah,
okay.
Yes.
Didn't he have something to do with country music? I believe in the background of the Monroe Brothers or Bill Monroe, who I overseen. I know the name has been connected with him and possibly with Roy Acuff. Do you know any of his country music background?
He recorded or supervised almost all of Bluebird's output. I mean, he did not just sit back at his desk and watch things happen. He was there. He was in Mexico City. He was on the road. He was everywhere. Gary, yes.
So was he responsible for the classical recordings issued under pseudonymous labels in the 1950s on the Allegro Royale label?
Probably. He certainly had something to do with it. I'm not sure what the exact relationship is. Ernst Lumpy did some work on that in the Arts Journal recently. It's not my particular field, so I couldn't say for sure exactly how those international things came about. David. Columbia pressed them, and he did all the marketing. The deal was that, first off, they had a whole bunch of older things that they reissued just to pad out the catalog, and then Eli would tell Columbia what he wanted them to record, they would record it, he would market it. Now, he had a pretty good-sized hit early on with Pearl Bailey's version of the Hucklebuck. Columbia kind of decided, well, why waste all this stuff on this Oberstein guy when we can do it ourselves? So they wanted to put out her next releases back on the Columbia label. And there were a lot of slowdowns and stop checks, and you know, there was just a lot of friction. I'm sure a lot of people at CBS were real unhappy that any kind of marketing was being farmed out, so it didn't last long.
Just for everybody's information, Eli did a fair amount of classical recording on his Royale label.
Yes.
Including the first ever recording of the Shostakovich First String Quartet.
Really?
A number of other oddball things. He did a fair amount of it, and these were domestically made. This was not stuff from abroad.
Yes, he had Jack Shilkret do a whole bunch of things for him, and like you said, a lot of oddball stuff that you're not going to see anywhere else.
Is there any information on who the people were in the anonymous masterpiece
classical? No. Nothing that I've come across. The paperwork is long gone, unless you happen to find, you know, an article somewhere in Variety that mentions so-and-so is recording for Masterpiece, but I doubt that you'll find much, unless you find some personal memoirs of maybe some local New York Symphony people who participated or something like that.
Well, there was a rumor at one time that they were made in Cuba, and this was the period when Erich Klein was conducted.
Anything is possible, but I'd be surprised if Eli went all the way to Cuba to do anything. He had lots of connections in New York City, and he managed to get a lot of things done there.
Actually, there was a Varsity 3000 Cubit series that has some very interesting material on it. It's not clear where those masters were made. They were U.S. masters in the convection series. But it's curious that the label contains people that were prominent in New York, but it also contains other recordings by Trios Armando Diaz that were never known to have come to New York to record. Musicraft in 1940 had gone to Cuba to record the Havana Philharmonic, whose works they could get very inexpensively, and they did some wonderful Cuban-style Cuban recordings when they were there. And it's not clear whether or not Eli might have been part of that operation. Vis-a-vis that elite label, there's an elite labor in Switzerland whose masters turn up on varsity. I know of no formal connection, but it suggests that that may have been, because that was an independent Swiss labor in the 1930s, that may have been a source for some of the obscure and otherwise undocumented classical masters
Eli reached out everywhere. Rondo had nothing to do with Eli?
That was out of Chicago.
Yeah, I know, but the information I have is that it was one of his labels. It was his until he died, and his son took it over. His son Maurice, by the way, went on to his own career. And I think he worked for Sony over in Europe. But I believe my time is up. I'll be happy to talk with any of you at any time.
Thanks, David.
Thanks. Okay. God, you're tall. Anyways.